And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Floods are nothing new. People have been struggling to higher ground for as long as anyone can remember, as hopefully the waters crest. And the good news is that the current levees are holding. It's going to take a long time to get things back to normal. But what about the small creatures? How do they deal with floods? And as summer heats up, how do animals deal with the blistering heat? That's coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News.
The river's on the rise, swift and gentle like the breeze. It swallows everything but sky. It suffocates the trees. Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? And does it even matter if I sing? If I sink or swim.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Well, it looks as if we're in for another record weather year, 2008. As we watch the media present us ongoing images of this extraordinary flooding along the tributaries of the Mississippi River. Literally thousands and thousands of people across the Midwest are impacted once again. This is the new Katrina, and it's weather-related, and so a lot of people are suggesting that perhaps this is an indication of the effects of climate change. The hard part about all of this is there are lots of people who are dramatically impacted, and those people out in the Midwestern states who are going through this right now, it's almost like I don't really know what to say. It's real tough to watch as the floodwaters come in and take out your home and take out your community. We've been through this before, but each time it's real for those people up to their armpits in water. It's really tough on we humans because we invest so much in our possessions and our home and our way of life. But as well, floodwaters affect virtually all the living forms around we human communities. And that's what we're going to take a look at today in our first segment as we talk to some experts about how flooding affects the small creatures and the aquatic communities. What happens to them? How do they deal with this? In the second segment, eventually the waters are going to recede, and in some places there are no waters. The heat of summer already in many cases has been here, but I have the sense that this is going to be a hot summer. We just went through a very hot phase here in San Diego. And of course, what happens here, then you can just watch it across the nation. So look out, folks. There's a heat wave coming. But again, the question is, what do the wild creatures do? How do they handle this? And that's what we're going to be looking at in our second segment. So stay with us here on the Wild Side News as we really focus on the effects that floods and heat have on the wild creatures, because they too have to deal with these natural disasters and natural realities. But I thought before we get into that, we might cover a few topics that are making the news these days. Oil prices continue to bobble around and typically are bubbling up. It's a crude reality that's impacting us. And this despite the fact that OPEC recently has committed to produce 200,000 additional barrels of oil per day, which actually, if you think about it, is nothing. It will make no difference. And unfortunately, these increased oil prices are being felt in many ways. We're all feeling the pinch almost all the time. It hurts to go to the gas station. Here in San Diego, we're looking at $4.80, $4.75 a gallon all the time for regular gas. One of the difficult aspects of this is that this becomes the cause celeb for a new way of thinking about energy independence. As you listen to politicians, now the word is that we're going to drill our way out of this. It's amazing to hear what's happening. Energy independence is now being touted as going after all the resources here in the United States. It's all our fault. We environmentalists, again, have done it all wrong, although we've been talking about it for the last, 30 years, suggesting that this day would come, and if we used our intelligence and began to really address this, we could avoid this. But no, here we are, and of course, we are the ones who are standing in the way. So there's a lot of pressure now, and the president has suggested that we remove the 30-year ban on offshore oil drilling and exploration, and I fear that's just the beginning. I was listening to C-SPAN this morning and heard a Texas congressman talking about that when you look at the amount of pollution on the shorelines, he had a chart, and he was saying that, I'm not going to get these exactly correct, but like 56% of the oil pollution along the shoreline is due to nature. Yep, it's Mother Nature again. And then 37% was due to recreational boating, and about 6% was due to ocean-going vessels, and ultimately, he said, 2% was due to oil spills. Probably his statistics are correct. But what he failed to discuss was the fact that if we talked about the percentage of catastrophic oil incidents along the ocean, those numbers would be totally turned around. I can't think of a single incident where Mother Nature has caused catastrophic oil damage along the shorelines, nor can I recall a time when recreational boating has caused catastrophic oil damage. But certainly oil spills in various forms have probably represented about 98% of the catastrophic damage along the shore. People whose livelihood depends on beaches and shorelines know that when you find your beach is covered in tar and all the wild creatures, the birds and otters and others, covered in goo, that's different than the kind of ongoing oil that Mother Nature may be creating. But anyway, the point is, watch out, folks, and become activated, because the pressure to open up offshore oil is going to increase. Along with that comes a call for us to drill our way out of this situation. I was listening to CNBC, the financial network, and there was a talking head, and he had some people talking about the current status of oil and whether or not speculation was the cause for the high increase in the oil versus just the markets. And he had this mantra that was drill, drill, drill. We're going to drill our way out of this, although almost anybody who knows anything about this knows that you start drilling, it's going to take probably 8 or 10 years before actually that comes online. And you know what? That just isn't going to make a difference dramatically in the price of oil right now, price of gasoline. And the truth is, much of the high cost of oil is due strictly to speculation. Large-scale investors, now your institutional investors, are taking portions of their portfolio and investing in oil futures, and as well investing in the indexes. That is to say that they invest in the value of the oil index, and they make money if it goes up or down. And they want it to go up. And so to a large degree, what we're paying for right now is due to investors and speculators. Many of us know that already, but we have to keep this in mind, that we're really being impacted by something very unnatural, something other than the usual laws of supply and demand. There are things we can do, and it's amazing how simple some of this can be. Over the weekend, I took a journey up north about 130 miles on the quest to get a really good deal on a new piece of electronic gear. I don't usually take journeys like that, but this was such a good deal I couldn't pass it up. And I thought this would be a perfect time to experiment to see to what degree driving more slowly could impact fuel efficiency. So on the way up, I drove normally, which actually meant here in San Diego, Southern California, on the highways, that's pretty much 80 and above. And on the way up, the 130 miles, I got about 22 miles per gallon. Cost me $32. On the way back, we agreed that we would hold our speed to 60 miles an hour to see what might happen. My gas mileage went from 22 to 32 miles per gallon just by slowing down to 60 miles per hour. I was quite honestly amazed that there would be that much of a difference. That was a 40% increase in gas mileage. There's a real huge lesson there to be learned. Slow down and save not only the country but the world. We drive too fast, and these cars really don't function efficiently at those speeds. Because these cars have been made to maintain high speeds like that, when you get back to 60 miles per hour, they're just cruising along. This is easy. The increase in gas mileage is radical. Instead of spending $32, I spent $17. That makes a huge difference. Try it. When I was first encouraged to drive at 60 miles an hour, I thought, that's kind of a pain. I don't like to be a troublesome on the freeway. But you know what? There's a lot of people out there right now who are trying this. You get over into the right-hand lane, you find a lot of friends going 60 miles an hour. Driving through L.A., it was amazing to see how many people were going about 60 miles an hour. It was as if people are getting the message. And here's the bottom line. 60 miles per hour is easy to drive at. It seems like a more human speed. There were stretches of the road where pretty much everyone was going about 60 miles an hour or so, and it was almost like it was a bunch of friends traveling along. It was so much easier. So if you want to save some money, slow down. Try it yourself on any kind of extended journey, maybe 60 miles or 40 miles. Fill up. Top it up. Drive normally. When you get to your destination, fill up. Top it up. And then drive at 60 miles an hour on the way back. Find out what happens. I think you may be amazed. So that's my tip for the week. Give it a try. Drive 60 miles an hour. Now let's get into our feature for the day, which is the effect that flooding has on wildlife. A number of years back, I was a naturalist in a state park in Minnesota, St. Croix State Park, and we went through a terrific week of rains, and the rains collected in the rivers as they should, and the rivers swelled and created flooding in the middle of summer, actually late summer. And I'd heard that actually there had been some campers who were camping along a river in a little county park in their tents, and the waters rose so quickly in the middle of the night that they had been swept away. And I heard the story, and so I was amazed that the waters could come up so quickly. So in the middle of the night, I headed out to check out the location of that flood. It was right by a bridge that crossed over the river. And by the time I got there, down below at the bridge level, there were all sorts of red and flashing lights, and they didn't want people to head down the slope down to the river bottom. I was in my vehicle. It was raining, and my lights shone along the highway down to the scene below, and something caught my eye. I couldn't quite make out what it was, but it was as if the roadway was shimmering. It was just like it was organic diamonds. And I thought, what in the world is that? I'd never seen this before. So I got out of my car and took a close look, and it turned out that it was a worm stampede. Worms by the millions running as fast as they could up the roadway to escape the flood. I'd never seen anything like that. And that inspires actually today's story, which is what other creatures are affected by this, and how are they affected, and how do they deal with this flooding? So that's what we look at now. We start out by focusing on the effect that flooding has on the aquatic creatures, those animals who like water. Let's find out. With all the flooding that is devastating the Midwest and now moving all the way down, and it's going to continue its way down the Mississippi and expanding out. We've seen this before. Every time we see these floods, it's extraordinary to try to figure out how in the world people are supposed to cope. But there's obviously another side to this. Huge areas are inundated with water, and that water can stick around sometimes for a few days, sometimes for months as it has in the past. And I was curious what happens to the wildlife, the myriads of forms, particularly in the Midwestern zones like that, that are impacted by these floods. And to learn more about this, we're going to now talk with Dr. Greg Sass, who's the director of the Illinois River Biological Station. In Illinois. Dr. Sass, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much, Sydney.
Why don't you give us a brief overview of what the River Biological Station is doing?
The Illinois River Biological Station is a field station of the Illinois Natural History Survey. Our main purpose of the reason for our being is we monitor an 80-mile stretch of the Illinois River from Peoria down to Beardstown. Most of our monitoring is related to the fish populations and water quality. We're charged with this from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers because there's navigation on the Illinois River and the Upper Mississippi River system. We want to make sure that the natural resources aren't being hurt in any way, and that's the real purpose of our monitoring. We also do a lot of other independent projects related to fish and water quality, restoration ecology, and just aquatic ecology in general.
Well, have you had a chance to actually witness some floods?
Absolutely, especially the one that's going on right now. With the Illinois River, we jumped up on this latest flood about 2 weeks ago by about 8 feet, which isn't super unusual for the lower Illinois River, but I was actually just down in the Alton area and witnessed some of the flooding firsthand this past Friday night.
I know that your specialization is aquatic. Just briefly, though, before we get into your area, what happens to the observable wildlife? Any stories you can share?
This is really the natural state of things. Maybe not the 500-year floods, the 100-year floods that we're seeing, but before commercial navigation and much of the altering of large river systems, this annual flood pulse was a annual occurrence, particularly a little bit earlier in the springtime. Being this a little bit later, it's a little bit different. So wildlife is actually pretty adapted to these sorts of changes on an annual basis, and many of the species, such as fish, for example, are adapted to this, that they need those areas to increase the amount of food that's available to them, also for spawning habitat. Other organisms, I've talked to some of the herpetologists that some of the frogs should do very well, particularly tree frogs, because they have a lot more available habitat with water than they would without flooding. So many of the creatures actually do really well. In the case of fish, the 93 and 95 floods that occurred on the Illinois River were actually some of our largest year classes of many of the fish species that we haven't seen since that time. So for the native fishes, this might be a pretty important flood.
This actually, at least for a period of time, potentially expands their base, the extent of their populations?
That's absolutely right. So if we think about a river that's normally a conduit of water that's not attached to its floodplain in many cases, there's an awful lot of area that fish and other wildlife cannot access. So during these floods, they have a lot more available habitat, not only to feed, but also to spawn and reproduce.
Now, following the flood as it recedes, I'm just curious, particularly about the fish, to what degree do they die off, or do they get back into the main channel?
It depends if it's an isolated backwater system or not. In the case of a situation where a levee is topped, for example, and water gets into a farm field, let's say, that water may be trapped there for 2 to 3 years, depending on the underlying water table. In many of our systems, both in the Mississippi and the Illinois River, when water gets in, it can also either be pumped back out or just naturally released back into the river. So it really depends on whether it's an isolated backwater or one that's still connected to the river during the flood.
Now, do fish sort of naturally flow into those areas then? To what degree is that evidenced?
It's very evident, especially right now. Like I said, many of the fishes are adapted to that flood pulse, so they move into areas where they're able to exploit new sources of food. They're able to increase their spawning habitat. They take care of that, and then as the water recedes, usually their juveniles are already produced. They're up in the water column, and they come back out into the river to feed on the resources that are in the main stem part of the river.
As you look out throughout the region there, tell us about this particular flood and how it appears to you and what people are talking about.
A couple of the big things for around here, obviously Asian carp, both the silver and bighead carp, are invasive species in the Illinois River that are causing a lot of problems. They're getting ever closer to Lake Michigan, the electric barrier, south of Chicago. The flood pulse triggers their spawning event, and right now there's literally billions of young of the year Asian carp out there in this last flood pulse. So that's obviously concerning, given that their abundances are really high right now. Other people here are talking about waterfall food, for example. So typically the river gets lower throughout the summer, and the backwaters and wetlands will dry out, producing a lot of moist soil vegetation, which is very good duck food, particularly in the fall when they're making their migrations. There's a little flood pulse typically in the fall that fills those areas up and makes them accessible to ducks and their feeding. So right now there's a little bit of concern about whether the moist soil vegetation will come up or not if this river stays high throughout the entire summer.
Just curious, in your field and amongst your colleagues, to what degree people are suggesting that perhaps these types of erratic flooding may be changing into the future here, perhaps because of global warming or whatever?
Global climate change is definitely predicting what we're seeing right now, basically just stronger storms, more precipitation, just in the past couple of years throughout the Midwest. I think that's become pretty evident. However, from a wildlife perspective, in other places it's also getting drier. So we definitely might be seeing some changes, whether it's a blip on the radar or just a short cycle. We can't say for sure, but you know, the past couple of years and some of these floods and the timing of the floods are definitely different than what we've noticed throughout history in the hydrograph.
I know from my perspective, because I follow these types of things I have all my life, it feels as if this seems to be a change, but perhaps it's just better coverage, much more available coverage on the spot, you know, within minutes mm-hmm. of these events. Any thing you can share about that?
It's so hard to say because climate's been changing at different time scales for such a long period of time, and obviously the past couple hundred years, I guess, as far as carbon dioxide and methane production has gone up, to scales that more quickly than we've seen. So it is still difficult to say, but it definitely seems that, in particular, like in our history here over 20 years, we've seen pretty large increases in average water temperature throughout the course of the year in the river that we've monitored, like I said, over the past 20 years. And so we also know over the past 150 years that ice on dates and ice off dates in the northern hemisphere, ice on has been later and ice off has been earlier. Mm-hmm. So those would be suggestive of global climate change. It's always difficult to predict on a year-to-year basis what you're going to get, but it seems like if global climate changing is occurring, what the predictions are is just kind of more extreme events like the ones we're seeing right now.
I use the term global weirding, and I think it actually is a better way to look at it.
It definitely could be. It just seems like things may be a little bit more variable and less predictable now than they may have been even 20 years ago.
Well, Dr. Greg Sass, I know you're busy. Why don't you give us a website so that people can find you?
Sure, www.inhs.uiuc.edu.
Thanks a lot. Get back to the field now and figure out what's going on out there.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
But what about the creatures who have to pick up and run to get out of the way of the flood waters? In other words, mammals like us. How does flooding affect them? We find out now. Focusing on the massive flooding that, once again, is heading down the major river systems of Mississippi and its tributaries along the Midwest, I want to focus now on what happens to the untold millions and millions of small creatures, particularly the mammals that have to run for their lives or something when these floodwaters come in. And someone who has had some experience with researching this is Dr. Kenneth Wilson. He's a professor and department head at the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. Dr. Wilson, welcome to the Wildside News.
Oh, thanks. Pleasure to be here, sir.
I'm a biologist myself. I always have wished that I could be out in the field. I can't think of anything more enjoyable. Unfortunately, that's not what I'm doing, although I enjoy what I am doing. But what is your passion in terms of your work?
Oh, I'm really looking at a lot of the impacts that humans have on wild species. I've worked quite a bit with rodents, and now I'm also working with black bear populations with the Colorado Division of Wildlife and USDA, trying to understand how they move through urban areas. And so that right now is a huge passion in terms of the time I have to get out. But mostly the students have the fun.
Just because you brought that up, I am just curious. It's been my impression that the encounters between urban populations or suburban populations and some of these larger mammalian species, cougars, bears, is increasing. Anything to share about what your thoughts are on that?
There does seem to be an increase in the number of interactions. I don't think it's the wildlife changing their behavior. I think it's we have larger populations of humans moving into their habitat. So in Colorado, where I live, more people are want to live in a home that has a few acres, and we're really displacing these animals. We have to learn to live with them if we want them around.
Because I don't have to sign my name to my ideas, my theory about this is one of the contributing factors is that people are a little more friendly towards animals in their zones, whereas before these animals were just shot almost on the spot. There's a little more tolerance, a little more interest in perhaps allowing them to be there, but that's just my idea.
Certainly, I think that may be a contributing factor.
Mm-hmm.
We used to hunt a lot of the animals that come into the different areas we have, or in some cases, we just didn't tolerate them, such as mountain lions. Black bears were more of a game species, but at the same time, we certainly wouldn't tolerate black bears coming into a chicken coop. But now we are. We like them around. We like to see them at the right distance.
We're all becoming little environmentalists and ecologists, and that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, listen, let's get on to our topic today. You have had experience with some of your, particularly your graduate students, have been out in the field researching what happens to these small creatures. Why don't you give us a concept of, as the flood starts coming in, give us a perspective on the nature of the wildlife that's most dramatically impacted. Obviously, the larger, the deer and bear and others, they run. But some creatures don't have that option. But who's impacted?
Well, what we found, we were looking at a system, the Yampa River and the Green River in Colorado, is that even though there are animals that lived right adjacent to the river, and most of the rivers in the Colorado River system don't flood a lot, and even what's flooding now through the Mississippi drainage in Missouri, they don't have the traditional natural flooding year to year. Some of them close to the areas immediately adjacent, we found that they actually did die. They did not escape the floodwaters, and those that were burrowing died in their burrows. Mm-hmm. We were looking at primarily a species of kangaroo rat. Other species that were more mobile were able to move away and come back. In this case, where you have what looks like some sort of 100-year floods, I suspect quite a few more do succumb to the floodwaters if they don't have time to escape it. No different than the humans that we've seen, which can be quite tragic.
Of course, the bottom line is this has been going on for millennia, and so these animals have adapted, obviously, because they come back. What do they do? Those who try to escape, what are their options?
Yeah, if we think of the animals we might see in our house, the little musculus, the house mouse, or a black rat or roof rat, ratus ratus, those sorts of things. There are a lot of similar small mammals, voles, deer mice species, and many of them are pretty good swimmers, one. So they're going to swim around till they find some refugia, and that could be a log going moving along in the water, or top of a house, a tree, a bush if it's the beginning stages of the floods. And so they'll hang out and spend the 2 or 3 days or even weeks trying to survive using those methods, and then move back into the areas they were flooded out from. I'm sure a lot are swept into a completely different habitat, so they end up redistributing themselves.
I have watched some of these little creatures swimming, and rats, for example, and they don't have any problem with that.
No.
They handle it very, very well.
Yeah, I think they're much, much, much better than we do. But you think of a lot of wild animals, they seem to do quite well in water, even if it isn't something they do on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. I've often imagined at the edges of the water, populations of these animals just sort of watching and wondering, when do I get a chance to go back home? Well, let's talk about going back home. When they go back, in many cases, it's a very different environment. A lot of sediment and a lot of the vegetation is gone. What happens after that?
Yeah, and in the system we were looking at, it was the scouring that sort of developed the habitat. Kangaroo rats were living directly near the river because it was nice and sandy, and the human regulation of dams was actually allowing more grasses and shrubs to move in. And so in some cases you might find some species that like this scouring that occurred more bare ground. And in other cases it may be a little bit tough to make an existence because you've got more bare ground, you got more debris. The plants may not respond in the same sort of way they would naturally, sort of like the farmers now talking about, can they get their crops out? Well, certainly some of the plants aren't used to this kind of flooding, and so the seed source may be lacking to some degree for a while. But they slowly will rebound in most of these areas. It just may take a while. Others may respond rapidly to the changes that occur. Unfortunately, oftentimes some of them are the introduced species, like rats and mice, that can adapt quite well to some of the human changes that we do to the landscape.
Any idea on how long it takes to reestablish a healthy population? Of course, it varies all over the place, but I'm just curious. You check back a couple of years later, and they're everywhere.
For rodents, because they have such a rapid life cycle and short-term gestation periods, it doesn't take long at all. I mean, I would think, one, that here we are in spring with this sort of flood, those that get there, the competition is less, potentially. Once the seeds do get there and they'll have all this moisture to develop some hardy seed crops, if they can survive off of that, the insects, many of the small mammals and rodents are sort of omnivores to some degree. They'll feed on vegetation, but they'll also feed on insects. And so I think they could do quite well. And then if it's a warmer climate in the Midwest, they could still have a couple of birth cycles before the winter comes on. So I don't think it'll be very long at all. I think there may be other cycles that are playing year to year that will have an effect on their population more than this flood. Now, there may be some species, something like a gopher, who lives in a burrow, and it may take a long time for the water table to go down, longer than they'd have to deal with. They certainly also can swim and will find refugia, but that may put more of a damper on something like a pocket gopher than it will on something like a mouse or rat that runs and lives more on the surface.
Miles Falk, I think, was a graduate student who who did some research on this, and it seems to me as if he indicated, and I didn't do a deep read of his paper, but that, interestingly enough, populations that are adjoining these areas really aren't all that dramatically impacted. You'd sort of have the sense that all of these cousins and uncles, you know, would take over and affect them, but apparently it doesn't have that much of an effect.
Yeah, and I think in our system, the dynamics were very, this was sort of a natural flooding, and the river would expand and certainly go up the bank, and it might, in a flat area, move out about a quarter of a mile away. But in many cases, you're talking hundreds of yards, whereas now we've had this huge flood, and it's flooding, you know, miles away from the river. And so maybe some of those that do live in that floodplain, though, are the ones that are going to spread out. Maybe they're a little more adapted to this sort of a change, and sort of hanging out in a tree is not such a big deal. On the other hand, if you live a mile away, it's got to be something that you haven't seen in your lifetime.
Fascinating work. Do you enjoy your work?
Oh, I do.
Students that you're working with these days, how are they approaching all this? Is there seeing any changes in sort of their desire to learn about the natural world?
Oh, I think there's still a huge, huge desire to understand the natural world. And so I think from a wildlife and conservation biology and fishery biology point of view, we have some of the best students in the world. They have a large passion for maintaining our ecosystems and making sure that they exist for a long time. Mm. And at the same time, you know, the competing risks sort of life are very different. You know, computers and games and not as many people are going in the outdoors, and there's been a change. But there still is just a large desire to understand what's happening with wild populations.
We're going to have a lot more educated people doing real field research into the future here to figure out the trends and how to deal with that. Dr. Kenneth Wilson, I want to thank you for joining us here on the Wild Side News. Well, I'll let you get back to your studies and work.
Oh, my pleasure, Cindy.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And now there ain't no more higher ground. As far as I can see, my heart begins to pound. You know, it's getting tough to breathe. Here comes the water. Struggle or give in.
All of you listeners out there can become field biologists by just opening up your eyes now, those of you in these flood-ravaged areas, to take note of unusual occurrences of animal life. To what degree are they in trees or on the edges of these rivers? Or what is happening? What happens when all sorts of rabbits are forced to head on out? I don't have the answer to that, but I certainly would love to hear from you. If you have any observations about wildlife and its response to floods, I'd love to have you contact me. Send me an email, and you can do so by going to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.NET. Let me know. Love to hear from you. Coming up, we change our focus now to after the deluge. As the summer heats up, how does wildlife deal with the heat? And your voice of the year continues here on the Wild Side.
Some of them are dreamers. Some of them are fools. Who were making plans and thinking of the future. With the energy of the innocent, they were gathering the tools they would need to make their journey back to nature. While the sand slipped through the opening and their hands reached for the golden ring, with their hearts they turned to each other's hearts forever. Troubled years that came before the deluge.
Seven,
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
As we reach, hopefully, the high water point for this season's floods, we next have to consider the heat of summer. Already there are signs that this will be a scorcher, and with the ongoing drought affecting the western U.S. and now spreading into the Midwest and Southeast, wildlife will face another stress on their survivability. We talk with someone who works with these neighborhood friends when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News. Our discussion about our animal friends that make up our life also goes into an area that a lot of us really don't think about that much, unfortunately, and that is the fact that within our communities, we're surrounded by wildlife that we see on occasion, and most often at night when they start to come out. But, you know, during the day, they're trying to figure out how to cope with this heat, too. And joining us now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Laura Simon, the field director of the Urban Wildlife Program of the Humane Society of the United States. Laura, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
You have a very interesting specialization, and that is urban wildlife. Am I right? Do a lot of people really not pay as much attention as they ought to with these creatures that make up our neighborhood?
It's very true. I think people either don't pay attention to them, or when they notice them, they panic, because a lot of suburban and urbanites are not accustomed to the kinds of wildlife you see increasingly in urban and suburban areas. So people don't know much about their wild neighbors, and so they have a lot of questions and concerns, and they also run into conflict with them every once in a while. So we fill the gap by trying to teach people how to live with wildlife and how to understand them.
It's interesting you say that these animals seem to be appearing more often. What's the take on that?
Well, there's a lot of theories, but mine is that with the development continuing to gobble up more and more habitat, wild animals have fewer and fewer places to go, and they are forced into areas where there's high human densities. Plus, along the way, many wild animals become very adapted to humans and get used to living with us. They habituate to our presence and are happy to live in close proximity with us. So, for example, foxes, people see them out in the day, and the old thinking was, oh my goodness, if you see a fox by day, it's rabid. But red foxes in suburban areas are out and about by day all the time, and because that's when people put out cat and dog food. So they've adapted their behaviors, and it's very common and normal to see them out by day, but people don't know that.
Well, you know, I'm with you. I personally think it's important for us to learn to get along with this, with the urban wildlife, unless there's a reason not to.
Right.
But in most cases, these are gifts to us.
Yes.
And they enhance our lives, and we should really, I think, make a much greater effort to become familiar with them, try to find them, and then give them the respect that they deserve. Most of them are really just trying to get along with us.
Exactly. And I wish more people had shared your perspective, because it's true, animals are not out there to harm us or attack us. They're not dangerous. They're just trying to eke out a living like we do, and, you know, they're willing to be neighbors to us, and I think we have to become a little more neighborly.
Well, now, at times like this, when virtually almost everywhere in America, there is this phenomenal heat wave, what could you tell us about how these animals are having to cope with this change?
It's interesting, because wild animals are better adapted to deal with the heat. I mean, they're used to it. They're used to heat waves. And what they primarily do is just hunker down and get less active, and they make use of the water resources that are in their habitat. Even something like dew may become very important for animals at night. I mean, that may be their liquid nourishment. They also tend to switch over, if they can, to more liquefied foods like berries. And even insects have a very high water content for animals like raccoons. So they really conserve energy and they hunker down behaviorally. But we also encourage people to do things like, if you have birds in your backyard, which hopefully you do, you know, make sure you keep filling your bird bath. That's going to be important for the birds. And, you know, you can provide water, even the pond in your yard. You know, this is why we tell people it's really important to keep water bodies and streams in your neighborhood and not let development get rid of so many of these areas where there's water, because that may be the only water source wildlife has. And animals will take advantage of even the smallest little stream or puddle, and they get by. It's amazing how little water wild animals can survive on.
Obviously, if you see an animal, it's there because there's some sort of community. Almost always, it's because there is a successful community, so they've been able to figure out ways to meet their needs.
Exactly.
And as you say, in many cases, it's going to be some strange little pocket of water that they're aware of.
Right.
But
right.
Even at times like this, some of those as well may be disappearing.
Right.
Obviously, some people may decide that there's ways to assist. I don't really know what the best answer to that is. For example, let's say that you were concerned about coyotes that may be in your neighborhood. Is it appropriate to try to put out water or something like that? Give me a sense on that.
Yeah, I'm very mixed on that, because even though it's a kind thing to do, which, of course, we want to be compassionate to our wild neighbors, It's also tough, because when you put out food or water, you tend to attract animals, and it may become habit-forming. You start putting out food or water for them, and coyotes keep coming for food or water, and then they expect it to be there, and that may create a problem for the neighbors. But my personal feeling is, in times of supreme heat, you know, where it's just unusually high heat levels or drought levels, you know, I think if you do provision a bit with water, do it for a very temporary time period, and don't let it become habit-forming for the wild animals, because then they might, you know, start coming around to areas where other neighbors might not appreciate them so much. But bird baths, we certainly say please keep those filled. And even most importantly, and this is a battle we continually fight, is don't put out traps. Don't put out humane traps. Don't put out any kind of trap to capture any animal at this time of year, because they will literally die in the trap, and it's just the wrong thing to do. So if you need to rescue a wild animal like a skunk that fell in a window well, if you're going to do that, call us and we'll walk you through a fast way to get that animal out. But do not set any traps under any means, because the most humane trap will quickly become a very inhumane trap.
Since this is your field, you have really interesting experiences and stories, I'm sure. I'm going to kind of let you go ahead and just share some of the thoughts that you think about at times like this, maybe some of the things that you're becoming aware of, because I would find that fascinating. Just go ahead and talk as you would.
Sure. Well, we had an interesting one when I was thinking about water and drought, where these raccoons kept coming around to a house, and it was during a drought. And what they were doing is that the house, they had a leaky pipe in the house, and it was a perfect water source for these raccoons. But unfortunately, the homeowner got the leak fixed. I mean, that was fortunate for the homeowner, but not for the raccoons. And the homeowner called us and said, oh, my goodness, what's going on? There's a ruckus every night under my house. I hear screeching. And I had her hold up the phone, and I could hear that it was raccoons. And she swore up and down that, you know, she didn't put out food for them. And then I said, well, what could have been going on under your house that the raccoons were attracted to? And then we figured out it was, you know, she had this leaky pipe, and they had been really thoroughly enjoying it and using it. And but then suddenly she got it fixed, and that created a problem, because the raccoons were so used to coming there for water, and suddenly that source dried up. So in that case, I did tell her, I said, put a pan out of water, and we'll slowly wean them from it. And, you know, she couldn't sleep at night, so she did. And then when the drought ended, the raccoons had other sources of water, and there was no more problem.
Oh, that's just fascinating. And I'm intrigued by the fact that they were squawking about it.
Yeah. Well, it was the time of year when mothers had babies, and when they often, you know, the babies are very vocal. The parents, the mother is not. So the babies were just scrapping with each other. And what I imagine was happening is more than one mother was bringing her babies, and the babies were scrapping with each other, and that's what created the sound. Otherwise, she probably never would have known what was going on under there.
Well, tell us some more about some of the unusual things that may happen at a time like this, particularly when it gets very hot.
Yeah. Well, this one interesting thing, which many people might not realize, is that there actually are some animals that do benefit from heat. And, for example, people sometimes have bats in their attic, and we tell them this is not a bad thing as long as they're not getting into the inside of your home. It's great to have them in the attic because they will do free mosquito control for you every night, and, you know, it's wonderful. They can really make a dent in this mosquito population. But bats actually prefer hot temperature, like between 80 and 100 degrees, and little brown bats, which are sometimes in people's attics, actually seem to prefer temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you know, the heat spell is something they revel in, whereas other animals like us and any fur-bearing animal definitely are not happy about it. One other funny story we had, again, so many of our funny stories pertain to raccoons. We had a situation where there was a raccoon family in a chimney, and the homeowner, you know, we talked about it, and I explained to him how the babies would leave with the mother when they were 6 weeks old. She'd carry them out once and for all so that they could go on outings with her, and how it was hard for them to go up and down the chimney by themselves because they were too little. So that's why the mother, when they're big enough to go out on outings with her, she moves them to a ground bin. So I told the homeowner, you know, don't worry. All you have to do is just wait. And at 6 weeks old, they'll be gone. And so the homeowner was happy to do it, and I said, just keep your damper closed, and when this is all done, get a chimney cap if you don't want them to come back next year. So he said fine, and he did everything I suggested, except he forgot about the damper part. And he called me back, and he said, the weirdest thing is happening. He said, I'm a fish connoisseur, whatever fish people are who have exotic fish. He has 25 tanks of exotic fish. And he said, my fish are disappearing. Is there any disease you know of, or what's going on? And I didn't realize right away that he was the same caller who had called me about the raccoon. So we were trying to figure out why his fish might be disappearing. And suddenly it dawned on me what was happening. And I said, did you do everything I suggested with the raccoons? Did you close the damper? And he went, whoops, no, I didn't. And so he stayed up that night, and he watched. And sure enough, he said, Mama raccoon came down, went right over to the fish tank, got herself a nice little drink, and then went fishing, caught a whole bunch of his fish. He said the most expensive one she went for and got. Oh. And she just very neatly, because he had a couch up against the aquarium, she very neatly just did her fishing and drinking, and then went back in the chimney and took care of her cubs. Wow. And he got such a chuckle out of it that I think in the end he did not close the damper because it became so much fun for him to watch her come down and
hopefully
go fishing.
Hopefully he switched to some other species of fish at $19.95 or $29.95 for an exotic. That can
exactly.
be an expensive habit, you know.
Exactly.
That's a great story.
It was hysterical, but when he called again, he never identified himself as the same caller. He just said, you're animal people, you're the Humane Society. Why would my fish be disappearing, and, you know, what's going on here? He thought there were mice or something in the house that was having an impact. So that was just a funny story.
Yeah, it is good, yeah.
A lot of what we do is detective work, and, you know, wild animals, just their behaviors make sense, and we just have to put together the pieces.
Well, that's fascinating, detective work, yeah. As we think about this issue of heat and the urban wildlife, just go ahead and give us a kind of a cross-section of the animals that people probably aren't noticing but that are common in the urban areas, just because I think people, once they go, oh, yeah, that's interesting, I probably could learn to see some of these animals and be aware of them. Give them a sense of what they're really surrounded by.
Okay. Well, in most urban areas, I mean, you'll have... Are you in California?
I'm in San Diego.
I know in your area there's a variety of ground squirrels, but in our area we have chipmunks, which make small holes in yards, and they tend to live in stone walls and areas of edge where forest meets lawn. And people will often see them. They're very cute, and they do a lot of chirping and disappearing, and they're very vocal. But people don't always like the holes they see in their yard, but then when they associate them with the creature that they enjoy seeing, then they usually enjoy them much more. The fun thing about woodchucks, you'll see them with bulging cheeks. They load up their pouches with food, and so they're kind of comical looking. Gray squirrels are probably the most common animal that people get to see in their yards and parks, and even in the middle of the most urbanized areas, you'll have a hardy population of squirrels if you have any green space at all. Wild rabbits tend to be more and more common, and people tend to not see them so much because they're pretty secretive. But in the summer months, like now, people will be mowing the lawn and encounter their babies, their nests, because the mother rabbit doesn't stay with her young. She just parks them in a hole with long grass, and lawnmowers tend to discover them. And that's how people know they have rabbits in the neighborhood. Raccoons are very common, and people tend to know about them when they're trash cans get upended, but they are taking advantage of attics and chimneys, and just about any place there's a niche, a raccoon will try and fill it. Skunks are pretty common in this area, and they are, people often don't know they're around till they smell them, till their dog tangles with them, but we have great solutions for that. Bats tend to be in attics everywhere, and most people never know about bats in their attic until they might go outside at dusk and suddenly see bats flying around and then swooping into a very small hole or vent in their house. So often people can be living with lots of wildlife in and under their houses and yards and trees, and they never know about them. Even if you go out at night and you take a flashlight and sort of shine it up in the trees, you might see glowing eyeballs looking back at you, and that's raccoons usually. Their eyes are very fluorescent and in the nighttime, and they will glow back at you. But, you know, they'll often be so quiet you'll never know. They're in the tree right next to your porch. But what we try and teach people is that there's lots of wildlife around you, but they're not harmful. They're just doing their thing, and if you, you know, aren't aware of them, they still might be there, and that's a good thing, you know. So try and look for them more and listen in the early morning to the incredible bird life you get in the most urbanized areas. It's incredible. Green space, even teeny pockets of it, will bring you a lot of wildlife. Particularly, it's interesting if you supply some water, because greenery and water are all many wild animals need, and they appear out of nowhere. Fox in the middle of New York City. People say, how do you get there? We recently had a couple coyotes go into central Manhattan. Nobody knows how they got there, but they'll get there time and time again because they're eking out a living and we're not giving them much space to live in, but they'll take advantage of the little scraps we do give them.
I was driving along last Saturday, early in the morning, and I live in North County, San Diego, and so it's quite a bit of green, and all of a sudden, walking across the road was a coyote, a little skinny, scrawny, and it's startling because it's thrilling. Quite honestly, it's thrilling to see these animals, and he looks at me, and there's some sort of communication where he's kind of going, you're going to be cool, right? And and then he wandered off, and I was, you know, it filled me with something that was so terrific. It's wonderful.
It is wonderful.
And as you say, it's funny, too, because the other night I woke up, and I had heard someone talking about the fact that birds, the sound of animals actually is distributed. They're not all talking on top of each other. Mm-hmm. So at night, I went out about midnight and started listening to the night bird calls, and I'll encourage all of my listeners to do this. Pay attention and realize that they're taking turns. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
When you realize that they're actually, one bird will go off for a while and no other birds will be calling.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden a different bird or other creature will make noises, and they literally share the sound space, which is fascinating.
It is fascinating. And they're actually, what people don't realize is that they're talking to each other. There's communication going on. It's not just everybody yelling at once. It's actual communication going from one animal to another, and it's absolutely fascinating. And, you know, things like, as you're saying, coyotes, an animal as wild as a coyote, there he just pops up and looks at you, and, you know, you form this rapport. It's just this incredible energy and empathy and connection to wildlife and the sort of the wilderness, the little bit that exists, you can have in a second of time just seeing an animal like that. And a lot of people out here tend to see coyotes in a different light because they all read The Big Bad Wolf and the fairy tales, and they think these animals were out to get them. Whereas we explain to people, you know, what coyotes are primarily looking for are mice. And, you know, if they look at you, it doesn't mean they're about to attack you. Right. They're just interested in you. They're looking at you like you're looking at them. But, you know, what they prey on is a whole different story. It's much smaller prey items that are far more helpless, and that humans are very safe from coyotes.
Well, I'm prejudiced because I consider these my friends. I always get the sense, and I approach wildlife with the idea that they actually are begging for us to just get along and mm-hmm. and cohabit.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's their natural inclination. I mean, it's so rare that any wild creature, unless they're provoked or they're diseased or traumatized, would attack humans. It's just
yeah.
very rare. What we're talking about is cohabiting with the creatures, and a lot of people that I know, when they find the creatures in their yards, they end up, you know, calling someone to come and remove it. What's your take on that from the perspective of the Humane Society?
Okay, we generally do not support or recommend removal of wildlife as a way to solve problems, and I'll explain why. The biggest problem is that during spring and summer, that's the birthing season for most wild animal species, and that's when they go in and under people's homes to have private cavities to raise their young. So this is the time of year when the worst thing that can happen is for the mother to be trapped out and her babies left behind to starve. And so we strongly discourage trapping for that reason, because when a person, say, goes and rents a trap or buys a so-called humane trap, they often trap out the mother, and whether they relocate her or kill her, they leave babies behind that normally starve. I mean, it's just a bad scene. Plus, the other terrible thing is that there's a new industry right now, a wildlife extermination industry that has grown up in the past decade or so. And it's one of the fastest growing industries out there. And these are people who will come to your home, and for hundreds of dollars, they will trap and remove wild animals for you. And some of them will kill them, some relocate them. But the outcome is the same. It's really not good for the animals, and in many cases, it's a very sad outcome. And it's not the approach we want to see. What we tell people instead is the problem is not that an animal is in your home. The problem is that there's food or a denning site there, and that's where you need to solve the problem. So if you're attracting animals to your home because you're leaving out garbage or dog food or cat food, you have to change your own garbage disposal practices or stop putting dog food and cat food out all night if you don't want to attract certain animals. And likewise, if you've got holes in your house, you are going to have animals in there with young. So the trick is to do a great home proofing job in early spring and go around your house on the inside and the outside and plug up any holes, because if your house has a chimney cap and you've got no holes in your house, then you're not going to have animals in your house. So that's the answer. And when we get calls from people who say have a raccoon family in the attic, the first thing we try and do is see if they'll give the animal a grace period. Let the mother raise her young until they're big enough and then allow them to leave on their own. And at that point, the person needs to close off the entry hole. A lot of people are willing to accept that. But some people really don't want that animal in their home no matter what. They want them out now. And in those cases, we teach people how to evict animals, meaning teaching the mother that the nesting, denning place she has chosen is no longer safe. And when we harass her, or when we teach the homeowner how to harass her properly, the mother will move her own babies out. And that's the most humane solution, because it's not trapping and removing animals and separating them from their mother. It's getting the mother to move her own babies out on her own. And often we'll use lights or different bad sounds, smells, different kinds of techniques to teach the mother this is no longer a place where you're welcome. But we always, always, always tell the person that getting the animal out is not the answer. If you don't want them to return, you have got to do that final act of home proofing, and that may mean putting a chimney cap on your flue or sealing up holes, but when the animal is gone, the problem's not gone.
It's educating the animal. These animals are very intelligent,
right,
and they know when they're not wanted.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, we have some comical situations, like we've dealt with a number of, speaking of water, situations where raccoons, you know, are taking advantage of boats because people aren't using or haven't been using them much, and so the raccoons take over and they have their young on boats, and, you know, they love it. They go down the dock at night and bring the kids with them, but then suddenly a person's out on his boat and here's a raccoon, a mama raccoon behind them. So animals will pop up in a lot of strange places, but if you tell mom this is not a place where you're welcome, she will move on. And that is the best answer, but trying to trap and remove her or kill her is just unnecessary. Plus, to pay somebody hundreds of dollars to do it is just crazy.
And quite honestly, you know, an interesting thing for people to try is when you run across animals like that, literally talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Try to explain. No, it sounds a little odd, but you know what? They're trying to read you. They're trying to figure out what you want.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
as you know, if you communicate to them that this is not a good place, they can tell by the sound of your voice that you're not. You know, they're very perceptive. That's just so fascinating.
Yeah.
Now we'll wrap this up at this point.
Sure.
And this has been a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
For people, and let's get back to the topic of the excessive heat, let's say people come across a wildlife creature mm-hmm. who they think is somehow being stressed by this situation one way or another. What should they do?
Yeah. Well, if they want to temporarily put out a pan of water, you know, as long as they don't just leave it out permanently, I think that can just help an animal get through a very heat-stressed time. And usually there's enough shelter for wildlife and even enough water that they really don't have to worry about them. If there's any water in a habitat, usually animals know about it, but certainly in the worst heat waves, if they put out a shallow pan of water for wildlife, you know, and I say shallow because, you know, mice and other animals jump into deeper pans and drown, but if they put out a shallow pan, that can help an animal get by for a few days or a week until the cooler weather and normal rainfall will occur. But I know in your area, animals are very well adapted to so little rain and water that I think that most of the time they're doing just fine if we just leave them alone.
Well, I mean, if you're driving along, let's say you're walking, and you see an animal that looks as if it's in trouble,
mm-hmm.
What would you recommend?
Well, if it's in trouble, it's probably in trouble because it's injured or orphaned or something else is wrong. And you can always call your state Department of Natural Resources or Nature Center to locate a wildlife rehabilitator who can usually help out, or at least answer your questions.
Well, Laura Simon, Field Director of the Urban Wildlife Program with the Humane Society of the United States, this has been just fabulous. You have a fun job, and you're doing some great work.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure, too. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now.
Mm-hmm, bye. You have to admit we are getting plenty of warnings that it's time, actually way past time, to make some changes so that we can somehow manage to get along between nations and religions and between we humans and the mystery of the living world that is doing its best to sustain life on Earth. Things are heating up. Let that be the warming. It's time to cool it down a notch or two and get back to the peace we all deserve.
So simple and so human, believe that they were meant to live after the deluge. Now let the music keep our spirits high. Let the buildings keep our children dry. Let creation breathe in the secrets. By and by, when the light that starts within us reaches the sky.
This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday, or any time in the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.